any of you know somebody maybe who makes mountains out of molehills? You know, they take something that's pretty insignificant and act like it's a huge deal. They major on the minors. Might call them a drama queen, right? They make big deals out of nothing. Now, I think we probably all do that to some degree, one time or another. But I think what's worse than that is making molehills out of mountains. That is, taking things that are really big and significant, maybe eternally significant, and treating them as though they are insignificant. Acting as if they're not really that big of a deal. Taking something that's central and very important and sidelining it. I think one of the things that we do this with often is sin. We want to push it to the side so it's not blaring in our face. We want to reduce it, minimize it, so it's not that big of a deal. I think that we do this with sin, making it a minor or a non-central issue. We see it this way because it just makes us uncomfortable. There's pride that hurts. We feel the weight of shame and guilt. We don't like to feel bad, and so we don't want to see it as that big. But this is a preference issue, not a reality issue. Just because we don't want to see something as big doesn't mean it's not. Just because we don't want something to be central doesn't mean it isn't. In fact, oddly enough, it is sin that causes us to want to avoid looking at and thinking about our sin. But I think maybe another reason why we often see sin as a non-central issue is because we think of sin as being a spiritual, a religious, or a theological concern, but not really of much practical or daily relevance. And what we do, if sin is merely a spiritual and religious issue, and if we take all of our spirituality and religion and we relegate it to certain events and activities of life, then what becomes of sin? If spirituality and religion are confined to just certain activities like we gather here, spend a few hours a week together, then sin is only in those areas and sin doesn't really have to do with most of our life. And so what we want then is practical how-to messages. We want somebody to say, hey, give me some tips on how to live life well, like for everyday living. Now, I want practical wisdom, not the theology of sin stuff. I mean, maybe we would even say, yeah, all that's important. And as Christians, we would say, yes, Jesus died to save me from my sin and from death and hell that my sin deserves. But that's already done. That's there. And so let's just kind of push that to the side and let's deal with everyday real life issues. If you would, turn with me to Ecclesiastes 7. And starting at the very first sentence of verse 15, it says, in my vain life, I have seen everything. Or maybe more appropriately, he says, I have seen all these things, all the things I'm getting ready to tell you. And when he says, I have seen all these things, he's saying, I've observed this in life, that there are some things I found to be true. These are some things I found to be true. I want to tell you about them. Well, what has he found? Well, in verse 27, it says, behold, this is what I found. Like he's searching out to find something. Verse 29, he says, see alone, I found this. And in verse 25, he tells us, I turned my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom in the scheme of things and to know what? What has he found? The wickedness of folly and the foolishness that is madness. Solomon, the writer of Ecclesiastes, we believe, sought to find out the truth about sin, to gain a better understanding of the foolishness of sin. He was seeking to have, and he's seeking for his readers to have, that's us, a right understanding of sin. Why? At least two reasons. One, because sin is the pervasive and central issue of our lives. There is no relationship, no circumstance, no struggle, no issue, no concern, no part of life where sin is not the all-consuming factor. It's everywhere. But number two, I would say that Solomon wants us to understand, have a right understanding of sin, because having a right understanding of sin will help us in innumerable ways. And not having a right understanding, death and worse is our lot. So what I want to do is I want to kind of walk us through these verses here, work through it, this passage, so we can have a better and a right understanding of sin. And I want to give you four or five beneficial reasons for understanding, having a right understanding of sin, because a right understanding is always advantageous, and a wrong one or a poor understanding is always disastrous. If you would look with me at verse 19, we're going to go to verses 19 and 20, and then we'll go back to 15 through 18. Ecclesiastes 7, 19 and 20. It says, wisdom gives strength to the wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. Together, these verses paint the picture that rightly understanding sin helps us to wisely navigate our way through this sinful world. Rightly understanding sin helps us to wisely navigate our way in this sinful world. Why is that? Why will having a right understanding of sin give us the ability to navigate our way through a harsh world full of sin and sinners in the best way possible? It's because by understanding sin, you're able to see reality with clarity and with focus, knowing that sin is the universally central and pervasive issue in all of life. That is, sin taints every thought, every word, every action, every decision, every attitude, and every response to everything in life. Sin is the issue. So we need to rightly understand sin in order to be able to navigate as sinners through a sinful world. Verse 19 says, though, that wisdom gives strength to the wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. A city is the land that is walled and protected, and it is strong. And to have a ruler in it is good. To have two rulers would be doubly good, but to have 10, well, that's supreme. That's the tops. You can't get better than that. Imagine all of the know-how, all of the ability, all of the connections, all of the power and influence that 10 rulers could have. But he says, I'll give you a 10 plus. It is one man who is wise. They're stronger, more capable, more protected than 10 rulers in a walled city. Here, I think to understand this, we should probably define wisdom. Knowledge and wisdom are sometimes used as synonyms, and that's okay at times, but often it's also, there's a distinction made, a nuance, where knowledge is the information you gain, it's the obtaining of facts about life, and then wisdom would be how to rightly and beneficially apply those facts of life for our good and the good of those around us. So it's taking the information we have and making it productive and effective. We could really simplify it, and I think most people would agree with something like this, that wisdom is simply knowing the best way to live the best life. It's knowing the best way to live the best life. The problem, however, is that a lot of people don't understand what the best life is. They think that the best life is one where you have more money than you can ever spend. It's where you have only health and no pain. No suffering, always, no sacrifice, always what your flesh desires at every moment. They think that is the best life. So Solomon, I think, would add to our definition of wisdom and say, yes, wisdom is knowing the best way to live the best life, provided that you understand that the best life is one that gladly honors God. The best life. The best possible life you could live on this earth is one that gladly honors God. So we could say that wisdom is knowing the best way to live a life that gladly honors God, for a full definition. And this is because when we gladly honor God, God protects us. Why is that wise man stronger? It's because God gives him that strength. Why is that wise man stronger and more protected? Because God does that. God blesses and guides and brings us safely through the harsh realities of this sinful world. And so here's the connection here, verse 19 and 20. This is where it comes in. Verse 20 says, surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. The Old Testament was written in the Hebrew language. And verse 20 in the Hebrew actually has a word that's not being translated here. It's the word for or because. So the connection is this. It's a causal connection. Wisdom gives strength to the wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city, for or because there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. Well, how does that work? Why would the universal reality of human sinfulness, verse 20, why would that mean that wisdom makes one more capable than 10 rulers in a city? What's the connection? Well, before we actually answer that, I think that we shouldn't move too quickly through verse 20. Solomon is not giving us a mere flippant, well, nobody's perfect. He's giving us a very carefully weighed, all-encompassing, absolute theological statement. No one is perfectly, sinlessly righteous. No one. It is as Paul says in Romans 3, 10 and 23, that none is righteous, no, not one. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. This is all encompassing. Not one person you know escapes this reality. Not one. The world that we have to navigate our way through is full of sin and sinners. So do you know what this tells us? It tells us that the only way for, verse 19, wisdom to be of any help for us in navigating through a world full of sin and sinners is that wisdom has something to do with the opposite of sin. Wisdom has to include righteousness for us to be benefited by it. Navigating through a world full of sinfulness requires the wisdom of righteousness. If no one is perfectly righteous, and if everyone sins, then we must rightly understand the foolishness of sin in order to live in the wisdom of righteousness. So again, I say that rightly understanding sin helps us to wisely navigate our way through a sinful world. It gives us wisdom for how to live in the sinful world. But what does this look like? I mean, in order to see what this wise navigation in a sinful world looks like practically, and in order to keep us from going too far with this and misunderstanding what Solomon's saying, we need a slight clarification, I think, at this point. Clarification is going to be in verses 15 through 18, and we'll see a practical outworking of what wisdom looks like in a sinful world. He says, in my vain life I have seen everything, or I have found all these things to be true. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness. He's not rewarded. He dies. And there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing, the opposite of what we'd expect. So be not overly righteous, and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. These verses together are telling us that rightly understanding sin protects us from both despair and danger. Rightly understanding sin protects us from despair on the one side and danger on the other. To put it more fully, we could say that having a right understanding of sin protects us from, on the one side, disillusionment and despair as we face the harsh realities of life in this crooked and broken world. And we see in verse 15 that righteous people can sometimes suffer injustice and wicked people can benefit greatly. We say, how do we respond to that? Will you be disillusioned and full of despair? If you understand sin, you won't be. And at the same time, having a right understanding of sin also protects us from foolish and dangerous extremes of living. Verse 16 and 17 says, don't be overly righteous and too wise, and don't be overly wicked, and neither be a fool. How does this work, though? I mean, how does rightly understanding sin protect us from these things? And maybe a more helpful question is, what is the connection between rightly understanding sin and fearing God? Because look at verse 18 with me. It's verse 18 that says, if you do these things, if you hold on to what I'm telling you and keep this, the one who fears God will come out from both of them. If you fear God, you'll be protected from despair and danger. But I'm saying that rightly understanding sin will protect us from despair and danger. So which is it? What's the connection here between rightly understanding sin and fearing God? And the connection is simply this. Rightly understanding sin causes us to fear God. Rightly understanding sin causes us to fear God. And I probably need to define our terms again. I've been using the word sin quite a bit, but what does it mean? It's a short, little, three-letter word that has big meaning. And we could define it in many different ways. We could say that it's rebellion against God, preferring anything other than God. It is. We could say that it's breaking God's commandments, going against God. But any definition we have must include a relationship to and what means it is against God. Any definition of sin that we have that does not include and focus primarily on God, we miss it. So I think maybe here's a really simple definition of sin. Sin is not gladly honoring God. Sin is not gladly honoring God. Now that probably seems awkward the way it's worded, and I know that, but I did it this way on purpose. Sin is not gladly honoring God. I want to say it this way for three reasons. One, because sin is not just what we do. I could have said sin is dishonoring God, but we think of dishonoring as something you're doing. Sin is also what you don't do. Don't just go around life saying, well, I guess I'm not really doing anything wrong, so I'm okay. If you are not actively seeking to honor God, it itself is sin. So it's not honoring God. But I also said sin is not gladly honoring God, because sin is not just what we do, it's also how and why we do it. How and why do you live the life the way you do? If you're doing right things, but with the wrong heart, God is not pleased. He is not honored. You should have a sincere, glad-hearted desire to obey him. I want you to be glorified. I want you to be honored, God. Sin is not gladly honoring God. Anytime you're living your life, even when you're doing what is right, if you are not gladly honoring him, it is sin. The third reason why I gave this definition, sin is not gladly honoring God, is because of our definition of wisdom. Remember, wisdom is knowing the best way to live the best life, provided that we understand that the best life is one that gladly honors God. So that wisdom is the opposite of sin. Sin is foolish. It might be pleasurable. It might be condoned. It might be even celebrated in many parts and in many places, but it is foolish. Wisdom is gladly honoring God. Sin is not gladly honoring God. But I think here we should also define fearing God. Because I said, what's the connection between rightly understanding sin that causes us to fear God? To fear God is to so value him as supremely special. Like there is no one like him. He's so unique in a class by himself, and that you realize that your soul knows that it cries out for him. That everything that you're looking to satisfy you in this world really has its end in God himself. That he is supreme in every perfect way. And that you value him as so high, so supreme, so special that you are afraid of going away from him. You are afraid of going against him. You fear not being with him. And if we fear God, it is because we understand that the best life is with him. We won't want to go against him or away from him. And if we don't gladly honor God, we know that this is precisely what we are doing. We are running against and running away from God. So to put it more positively and simply, we could say that to fear God is to gladly honor him. I hope you're seeing the connection here and not being confused in this. I'm telling you that fearing God is righteousness. Fearing God is wisdom. Sin is not gladly honoring God. That is foolishness. It's the opposite of fearing God. So now coming full circle here with these things in our mind, verse 15 again, where we see that there are times when righteous people suffer unjustly and wicked people seem to have unjust improvement and benefit in life and a prolonged life. And a right understanding of sin will keep us from being disillusioned and despairing in the face of such injustice and sin in our world for at least three reasons. Number one, if we rightly understand sin, we won't be shocked and disillusioned when people sin. Because we will understand what Solomon says in verse 20, that truly there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. This world is full of sin and sinners. You cannot be disillusioned if you don't first buy into the illusion that everyone is basically good and all this world needs is just some good education, better technology, and a reminder every once in a while to be nice. If you believe in the depravity of man, if the sinfulness of this world is something you get, and you won't be thrown for a loop when you see it. Number two, if we rightly understand sin, we will understand that no one is perfectly righteous, and thus, no one deserves a perfect life. When you see somebody suffering, you will see it makes sense. That's what we deserve. Any blessing we enjoy in this life is a gracious gift, not a just reward from God. Is that hard for you to grasp? There is no such thing as bad things happening to good people, because there are no good people in the ultimate sense. We all deserve temporal and everlasting punishment because we are all sinners. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. So when we receive injustice and sin in this world, we say, yeah. And when we receive blessing, we should be more surprised when we receive any blessing from God. We say, we don't deserve this. So any blessing we get is better than we deserve. And thirdly, even when we do understand that the pervasiveness of sin in this world, and when we're not surprised when we see it, and even though we admit that all people are sinners, and that no one deserves anything good but only judgment, it can and it still should hurt and make us sad when people sin against us or others. That is true. But what keeps this sadness from moving into despair? Fearing God protects us from despairing over evil people who seem to be getting away with it. It's the fear of God. Because when we fear God, what we're doing is we're gladly honoring him by trusting his perfectly timed, perfectly wise, and perfectly righteous justice for all evil. When the evil person seems to be getting away scot-free and they're getting, seem to have life at ease, we know that we can fear God and trust that he will take care of it. He will make right what others do wrong, because only by rightly understanding sin and so fearing God will we be kept back from despair in the face of this sin, because we trust him to be sovereign and to be holy. But verses 16 through 18, I want to connect to this as well. Remember, it says, be not overly righteous. Do not make yourself too wise. It sounds confusing. We'll get back to it in a second. Why should you destroy yourself? Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand. For the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. Now, as I said, this seems confusing at first glance, but let me tell you what it's not saying. It's not saying that a little sin is a good thing. Well, just don't be too righteous and don't be too evil. Just balance it out. Don't be a religious fanatic where you're trying to be righteous. It's not saying that. These verses are simply helping us to rightly have a right response to verse 15. The harsh reality that there are righteous people who suffer and there are evil people who seem to be blessed. How do we respond to that? These verses are telling us that it is dangerous to respond to such sin in the world by going to a foolish extreme. Verse 16, don't be overly righteous and nor too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? He's saying that if you live long enough, you will find it to be true that at times those who seek to live a righteous life and gladly honor God, they will suffer. They can be mistreated and hated and cheated and lied to and taken advantage of and even killed. They will perish before their time. But if you conclude from this that those righteous people who suffered, I guess they just weren't righteous enough. And that somehow maybe I can be more righteous than they, and so by doing that, secure for myself and guarantee for myself prosperity and health and a long life. If that's what you're thinking, then you are a fool and you are in great danger. Verse 17 says, but do not be overly wicked. He's saying at the same time, do not respond to the sinful and unjust suffering in this world by foolishly thinking, I guess it just doesn't matter how I live. Because if someone can be evil and just get away with it and have a great life, it doesn't really matter. I'll just let evil desires flow unrestrained. He says, no, that is deadly. Yes, we are all sinners. And we should confess that, but it doesn't mean that we should condone sin or commit ourselves to such a life. That only hastens our own destruction. Don't do that. The point is, we cannot control our circumstances. We cannot control our circumstances, be they blessing or adversity. We cannot control them by our morality, especially since it's so flawed. The reason why things usually go better for those who seek to live a righteous life and gladly honor God, and the reason why things seem to usually go worse for those who dive headlong into wickedness, has nothing to do with us earning anything from God. He's not obligated, nor is he impressed by our morality. God is the one ruling our circumstances, and he does it as a holy and wise judge. So if a person who truly does try to do good and gladly honor God, if they get hurt and tricked and dumped on, we must not think that they weren't righteous or wise or spiritual or religious or faith-filled enough. That's wrongheaded. That's foolish. And you go, well, I should just be more extreme in my righteousness, and then I'll secure for myself blessing from God. No. God is gracious, and God is sovereign. So fear him. That's it. We are all sinners, and all of our blessings come from God in his sovereign grace and his perfect wisdom. So be wise by humbling yourself. Humble yourself as a sinner and fear God, who alone is sovereign and holy and wise and full of grace. But in order to do that, we have to have a right understanding of sin that humbles us, which takes us to verses 21 and 22. It says, "Do not take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Your heart knows that many times you yourself have cursed others." That same word that's in verse 20 is also in verse 22, that Hebrew word that's not translated here for some reason. It's, "Do not," in verse 21, "do not take heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you, for," or because, "your heart knows that many times you yourself have cursed others." Don't be quick to judge others. Don't be quick to slam down on others, sinners, because you first know that you are a sinner. These verses tell us that rightly understanding sin, especially sin about ourselves, keeps peace in our lives. It keeps peace. Because having a right understanding of sin will give you an inner peace and a relational peace, because rightly understanding sin softens us as it humbles us. When you understand that verse 20, "Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins," when you get that that includes you too, then you will have a little more sympathy and patience and even mercy for other sinners. There's nothing quite like feeling the weight of our own sin to deflate our anger at the sin of others. Humbled people are gracious people, because they know that they have to look no further than their own heart to see the ugliness and the foolishness of sin. In 1908, the Times newspaper put out an article, and they sent a request to some authors asking them to contribute to answering one question: what's wrong with the world? One of the authors was G.K. Chesterton. They asked him to write a response to "what's wrong with the world," and he wrote a very simple and yet profound response. He says, "Dear sirs, I am. Sincerely yours, G.K. Chesterton." What's wrong with the world? I am. It's me. Because I am a sinner. Similarly, Paul David Tripp, in his book on marriage, "What Did You Expect?" He talks about how we will never in marriage as spouses get out of this vicious cycle of being hurt and hurting, of being hurt and hurting over and over and over again. We'll have this season after season after season until we get this one thing: that I am what's wrong with my marriage. Unless you really grasp it and say, "I believe it, that my marriage would be better if I were more like Jesus, if I were different, not him, not her, but me." We have to grasp our own sinfulness. And seeing the reality of our own sinfulness like this humbles us, and it gives us grace then. I heard somebody else, they said something bad about me, and I want to tame the tongue of everybody else around me. We can't even tame our own tongue. How many times have we said evil things about those around us? Look no further than your own heart. Be humbled by it. And when you are, you will be gracious toward others when they sin against you. And your relationships will be more at peace, more stable. Your heart will be more at peace and at rest, not always bothered by sin around you because you feel it in your own heart. And as Solomon thinks about all sin, this whole section, there are lots of sins that he could have named. Hundreds and hundreds that he could have focused on. But in verse 26, he brings out one. "I find something more bitter than death. The woman whose heart is snares and nets, and whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner is taken by her." This verse is saying that rightly understanding sin saves us from many sins. Rightly understanding sin will spare us from sinning in many ways and in many times that we otherwise would give in to. Because rightly understanding sin causes us to not only acknowledge our own sin and sinfulness, but to hate it. Understanding sin rightly causes us to mourn and to grieve over our own sin and to hate it, especially as we are turned more Godward. The picture Solomon gives here is a powerful one. There's this seductive woman who traps her men unto an end that is more bitter than death itself. Solomon speaks elsewhere of this. I'll just very quickly show you from Proverbs 5. The first seven chapters of Proverbs is replete with this kind of language. Proverbs 5, verses 3 through 5 says, "For the lips of a forbidden woman drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil. But in the end, she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps follow the path to Sheol." In chapter 7, verses 21 through 27, he says, "With much seductive speech, she persuades him. Her smooth talk, she compels him. All at once, he follows her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a stag is caught fast till an arrow pierces its liver. As a bird rushes into a snare, he does not know that it will cost him his life. And now, O sons, listen to me and be attentive to the words of my mouth. Let not your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her paths, for many a victim has she laid low. And all her slain are a mighty throng. Her house is the way to Sheol, going down to the chambers of death." Understanding sin, understanding sexual sin in particular here, leads us to hate it. So why would you pick on this sin in particular? And the sin of pornography and lust and sexual sin. I'm not picking on it, but I am emphasizing it because, one, Solomon does. He does, and I think he does so in part because he had many a woman in his time. And you can almost hear the sadness, the shame, the weight of guilt on him as he's saying this. He felt the ruin that it caused in his own life. And he wants to warn others and help others to escape such sins, which is my second reason. This is a prevalent and common sin. About 90 to 95% of people in this room at any moment of the day can go to their computer, their laptop, their tablet, their phone, and have a real or virtual connection with somebody who is not their spouse. You can close your eyes and look at no screen and still sin with lust. Your heart can lure you. People can lure you. And I want to warn you, I want to help you to escape this sin. So what do? You grow to hate it. To hate it with a fiery passion. How do you do that? You got to expose the sin for what it is. Expose the wickedness and the foolishness of it. Because you will never hate sin. You will never hate sexual sin in particular until you see the foolishness of it, the deadliness underneath it, and the lies behind it. You just won't. You go to passages like Proverbs and you read it and you say, "God, show me again and again and again. Help me to understand it." But in order to see the foolishness and deadliness of sin, and even in order to want to see it, you have to first desire to please God. You must have a commitment to want to please God. Who is he who escapes this sin? He who pleases God escapes her. See, hating sin comes from a desire to please God. And hating sin also leads to more of a desire to please God, to gladly honor him. That must be your desire. So first, you must ask the Holy Spirit to give you a focus, not on pleasing your own sinful flesh, but on pleasing God. Turn my heart toward him. Help me to see the excellencies, the glories, the beauties of my Savior. I want to see what is awesome about God, so that I will flee from it and run to him. So beg him to help you to see it as you read the truth about this sin in his word. Because you were created not merely to enjoy your sinful flesh and what it craves. You were made for more, much more than this. You were made by God and for God. That is the best possible life you can live is only with him. It is with him. It is gladly honoring him in every area of your life. And sin, my friend, your sexual sin will keep you from him. It will keep you from him. It will keep you from knowing him and enjoying him and gladly honoring him with all of your life. Your heart was made to find its ultimate satisfaction in knowing and pleasing God. And at the end of this sin is not the pot of gold that it was promised, but it is a shame and a ruin that is more bitter than death. But you can be saved. You can escape. He can free you. So seek to please God and ask him to help you to rightly understand the foolishness and the overwhelming burden that sin brings so that you may hate it and run from it and run to him. He will give you escape. We need to rightly understand sin. Well, there's one more problem that we see with rightly understanding sin. I just very quickly want to take these last few verses. There's a problem with rightly understanding sin found here in verse 23. All this I have tested by wisdom. I said, I will be wise. I will seek to really understand wickedness and the foolishness of sin, but it was far from me. That which it has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? So I turned my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom in the scheme of things and to know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness that is madness. Verse 27, behold, this is what I found, says the preacher, while adding one thing to another to find the scheme of things, which my soul sought repeatedly, but actually I have not found. I thought I could find, I wanted to find, but I have not found it. See, this alone I found. One thing I've understood. God has made man upright. That is, in their original nature, they were righteous, but they have sought out many schemes. Verse 28 adds one confusing phrase for us. It says, one man among a thousand I found, but a woman among all these I have not found. Well, what's the deal with that? What's the deal with saying all this talk about finding not even one righteous woman, but he could find one righteous man out of a thousand? Well, Solomon is merely giving his own personal experience with the men and women he actually knew. He's not giving some theological statement about all women. He's just saying out of the 1,000 women that he had, not one turned him Godward or helped him gladly honor the Lord. In 1 Kings 11:3, it says, he had 700 wives, this is Solomon, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. Ladies, if you're still balking at this, though, you say, well, he just seems misogynistic. Why would he say something so sexist as that, that he couldn't find even one woman, but he could find a man in it all? One, it's just his personal experience, and two, I think if you're still being in defense, you're missing the point. You are not righteous. You need a Savior. We have no place of defense. And men, if you're boasting and saying, well, at least he found a man and all of that, 0.1% ain't great odds. 1 out of 1,000. And that's just his own personal experience. You could find somebody else who says, well, out of 1,000, I found 3 or 4 women, but no men. It's just his personal experience. And besides that, look at verse 29. See, this alone I found, that God made man upright, but they, that is Adam and Eve, man and woman, universally so, they have sought, deliberately went out of their way to find many, not just one, but numerous schemes, inventions, new ways of rebelling against our Creator. That's who we are. Surely there is not one who is righteous and does good and never sins. That's all of us. So even the righteous man that he found out of this thousand, they weren't really righteous. They were still a sinner. We need to rightly understand sin so that we'll be humbled. There's no place for defensiveness. There's no place for boasting. We should be humbled. But part of this humble, sober self-judgment that comes from rightly understanding sin is knowing that there is more crookedness in our iniquity, that there is more wickedness in our folly, there is more anti-God rebellion in our moral compromises. There is more depth of foolishness and evil in our sinfulness than we can ever know. It's deep, very deep, and no one can find it out. Solomon is saying that there is so much about sin and sinners that we just cannot fathom. We cannot plumb the depths of it. But here's what we can know. That even though God made man upright, man is sinful and God is holy and he must punish sin. That's what we can know. And you look at this passage and it talks about perishing, it talks about dying and being destroyed, it talks about death and being snared and trapped, and all of this, the bitterness that is worse than death, all of this is emblematic and symptomatic of what is the ultimate end of sinners without God's saving grace. That is, it's a picture of, and it's a foretaste of what is more to come and more intensity. Like a woman in labor pains. Maybe Braxton Hicks, before it's actually real labor and moving on into actual giving birth, it's just a foretaste of what is to come with more intensity, more severity, more extreme. But unlike a woman in labor, there is no beautiful baby to cherish and bring home. Instead, what we give birth to is death, and that which is worse, the eternal suffering in hell. That's what we get for our sin, and that's what we deserve. So where does that leave us? Man is at the mercy of the God that he offends. The one we need is the one we are sinning against and running from. Just if there would be enough grace in God that he would send someone to come and rescue us. But alas, who would he send? We're all sinners. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. All are sinners. It is all but one. There is one. There is one beautifully sinless man. It is the God-man, Jesus Christ. Remember, I told you earlier that there is no such thing as bad things happening to good people. And that is absolutely true. Except for one man. There was one good man. And bad things happened to him. And he willingly chose it. To take it in our place. God made him who knew no sin to be sin so that we might become the righteousness of God in him. Jesus Christ came on purpose with a willing heart to gladly honor God his Father and to sincerely love people like us to live and to die on the cross and to rise again. And I pray that the words of 1 Timothy 1:15 will be in your heart and on your mind, and even on your lips as you leave here today. The saying is trustworthy and deserving of full acceptance, that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, whom I am the foremost. Would you pray with me? Oh, holy and gracious God, we need to rightly understand our sin. Would you give us vision, eyes to see, a heart to feel the foolishness, the wickedness, the ugliness of our sin? May we see Jesus as being so much more beautiful than our dark, ugly sin. May we run to him with full faith. God, may the unbelieving nature of your salvation not cause us to stumble. It's just wonderful that you would save sinners. Would you overwhelm us with this grace even more than you overwhelm us with the weight of our sin? We see the weight of glory and the weight of the cross. Jesus, thank you for bearing it. May you bring salvation. May you bring change. And you help us to gladly honor you in all things. In your name, Jesus, we pray. Amen.